Right, so welcome back. Today we will introduce the notion of metric, which will finally allow us to describe the shape of a manifold, its curvature, and so on. Because once we know how to describe distances on a manifold, clearly we can describe non-trivial shapes. And that will be very important, because once we have the metric, we can then also describe wave equations. So we will do the Klein-Gordon equation today and the Maxwell equations on a curved space-time. That we couldn't do it earlier is because, as you might imagine, when a wave propagates in a space or a space-time, then its propagation will be affected by the shape of the space-time. And as long as we cannot describe the shape, we cannot describe the propagation. So we have to first describe the shape. That's what we will do first, the metric. Then from that, we get another kind of, yet another kind of derivative, the co-derivative. And once we have that, we can write down the Maxwell equations, and we can write down the Klein-Gordon equations. All right, so how to describe distances on a space-time? Let's go back to Minkowski space. In Minkowski space, in special relativity, we know that there is a distance between two events. There's a notion of distance between two events that is independent of the coordinate system that you use to calculate it. And in a Cartesian coordinate system, the distance is the negative of the time difference between the two events plus the squared spatial distance between the two events. And that is, of course, usually written using a matrix eta mu nu. So the distance squared, which can be positive or negative, positive if space-like, negative if time-like, is given by this matrix eta mu nu times the distance, the difference between the four vectors. And the eta mu nu has this signature. There's also an alternative definition where we have a plus one for time and negative ones for space, but we will use this convention here. Now, that formula is true for arbitrarily large distances, and especially also arbitrarily small distances like differentials. Now, before we move on to curved space-time, what we can do is we can consider Minkowski space, so just a flat space-time Minkowski space, but in funny coordinates. For example, coordinates that rotate, coordinates that are addressed with respect to a carousel that rotates around, or an accelerated coordinate system, or just a coordinate system in which the coordinates are just wildly going around. In this case, the formula for the distance squared for the same distance between two events will be much more complicated. And in general, the quadratic term with which it starts is no longer going to have the matrix eta mu nu here, but it will have some much more general matrix here, which we can calculate easily just by applying Jacobians to this, Jacobian matrices, just change of coordinates. But we will also have higher order terms, of course, when we have higher order in the distance when we choose an arbitrary coordinate system. And the reason why we see tidal forces in nature, the reason why we see centripetal or centrifugal forces like on a carousel is, of course, a change of coordinates. And this is captured by going from this eta mu nu, from the Cartesian coordinates, to arbitrary coordinates, g mu nu. The point I want to make here is that even in the absence of gravity, we can have non-trivial matrices here that are not at all of that form. And the reason why this might be a matrix with lots of entries, space-time dependent entries, and so on, is just we've chosen a funny coordinate system. And this was this consideration that we can have wild matrices here, even in the absence of gravity, was the starting point for Einstein. He said, it doesn't have to be this matrix. It could be a very complicated matrix valued function here, and yet it doesn't describe gravity. And so Einstein then said, well, what if we allow not only such g mu nu of x matrix valued functions of space and time, which arise in this way, namely by changing coordinates from Cartesian to some curved coordinates, but what if we allow arbitrary g mu nus that may or may not, through a change of coordinates, turn into this form? So he said, let's allow g mu nu of x's, which in no coordinate system become each mu nu everywhere. Right? So if it's Minkowski space, just written down in funny coordinates, if it's Minkowski space, just written down in funny coordinates, then we could find a change of coordinates such that the g mu nu of x becomes the eta mu nu. But in general, we may be dealing with the g mu nu of x, which in no coordinate system at all can be put into this form everywhere. In this case, we will have that the motion of particles in no coordinate system is a straight line, because that's what it would be if that was that, right? So in other words, we have forces. And that, Einstein conjectured, is gravity. So simply by allowing to enlarge, simply by enlarging the set of g mu nus, symmetric, twice covariant tensors, just simply by allowing them not only to be such that they can be derived from this by change of coordinates, but also so those that cannot be arrived at by change of coordinates, he introduced gravity, a new description of gravity. However, the g mu nu of x is not completely arbitrary. Of course, it has to be symmetric in the x and the x prime, because the distance between the one event and the other event should be the same as vice versa. No, there's another restriction, and that restriction is Einstein's equivalence principle. Einstein said, let's leave the g mu nu of x completely arbitrary, except at every point of the space-time, it should be possible to choose a coordinate system around it such that at that point, the g mu nu of x is eta mu nu.
Okay.
Yeah.
There is an echo today, so I hope it is.
There's a what?
The recording. When you speak, there is an echo.
Yeah, there's a bit of an echo.
Okay. So let me just talk to the recording engineers. It's not from my laptop.
Somebody's laptop might be the feedback.
Is anybody on Zoom? No. It might be from the recording engineers. Please, if you have control over this, remove the loudspeaker here. All right, so why would we want that? It means that locally, at every point of the manifold, there is a coordinate system in which things look like special relativity. Right? Because at the point itself, the metric takes this form, but in the neighborhood, it can't be so different from it. So therefore, locally, things look like special relativity. And there are various versions of the equivalence principle. So there is the equivalence principle, which says that freely falling small masses should all fall the same way. And that's the weak equivalence principle. Einstein's equivalence principle is that not only freely falling small masses should fall the same way, but also that any non-gravitational physics should play out the same. So whatever electromagnetic or mechanical or whatever other physics you have going on, locally, all of that should not see gravity. Only if you make it so big that the gravity here and gravity there is different, then it will affect the experiment. And the strong equivalence principle says that not only non-gravitational physics, but also gravitational physics should be locally always the same. But we won't go into the subtleties of the differences between these equivalence principles. Mathematically, what we are going for is requiring the G-mu-nu to be such that we can pick any point in space-time and we'll be able to find a coordinate system around that point such that in that coordinate system, at that point in question, G mu nu takes the form of eta mu nu. By the way, if you are familiar with electromagnetism and its gauge principle, then you will have seen something like that before. Consider the A mu field of electromagnetism. We will later see that, that A mu field come up again. You see, by changing the gauge of the electromagnetic field, you can change what this A mu field is. And sometimes you can change the gauge such that the A mu field is even vanishing. In this case, there is no electromagnetic field around. We just gauged one into existence by choosing the phases of the electrons in this way. But on the other hand, sometimes the A mu field cannot be gauged away, because it's not the gradient of a scalar. And in that case, we do actually have an electric field and a magnetic field. And we can calculate a quantity from the A mu field, which is zero only if and only if there is an electromagnetic field. And that's the field strength tensor, which contains the electric field and the magnetic field, which is the exterior derivative of the A field. The details we will see later. The point is that it's very similar in gravity. The G mu nu of x, if you just are given as a metric tensor, a matrix-valued function of space and time that looks very complicated, then just because it looks complicated, you cannot conclude whether or not there is gravity described by this. What you have to check is there a change of coordinates such that everywhere at once it takes the form eta mu nu? If so, well, then it's just Minkowski space, no curvature, written in funny coordinates. However, if you cannot, if you can only do that locally, then there is gravity. Of course, it's very hard to check whether or not there exists a coordinate system such that G mu nu of x is always that. But you can calculate things from the metric, just like from the electromagnetic gauge field, A mu, electromagnetic potential, you can calculate the E and B tensor. Similarly, from the metric, you can calculate the curvature tensor. And the curvature tensor is only zero if there is no curvature. So there are parallels here between gravity and electromagnetism and all the other forces. OK, so how do we define then this metric tensor properly? Oh, interesting. My laptop had gone to sleep and it was still displaying. That's great. OK, so what's the mathematical definition of the metric tensor then? Well, mathematically, it is a covariant tensor of rank 0, 2. So it's twofold covariant and not at all contravariant. And that's because in special relativity it is. So how do we write it down then? Well, let's say we choose cotangent vector fields, theta mu of x, n of them. If our manifold has n dimensions, then we need n basis vectors to span the cotangent space. And let's say the theta mu of x are basis cotangent vectors. An example is given by the dx mu, by the differentials of the coordinate functions. Remember, these are cotangent vectors, and we can use them as a basis. We have previously several times expressed cotangent vector fields and covariant tensors in terms of these bases. So the metric tensor per se doesn't have any indices, right? It's a tensor. And when you write it explicitly in a basis, then its coefficient functions carry indices. Right? So theta mu of x for mu running from 0 to 3, that's a basis in a contention space. Here's the same, a basis in a contention space. The tensor product of the two gives us basis vectors of the space of covariant two tensors. And the metric is a covariant two tensor. So it has to be some linear combination of these basis vectors. And these linear combination functions, g mu nu of x, are scalar, right? They are zero forms. This is a zero form, g mu nu of x, for every mu, for every nu. That's just a number valued function, right? So this is a zero form, and that's a one form, that's a one form. The whole thing is not a two form, because we don't anti-symmetrize. It's a tensor product. It's just a covariant two tensor. And so these linear combinations are just covariant two tensors here. The g mu nu is required to be invertible, that is to say, non-degenerate. The determinant has to be non-zero, because if it wasn't, if the determinant was zero, it would mean that the distances on the space-time are such that in some direction, the distance doesn't change. You can move, and the distance doesn't change, right? That doesn't make sense. So the g mu nu is invertible, which means there exists a tensor G inverse, and that's going to be of rank 2, 0. So it's twofold contravariant and not covariant at all. And that inverse of the metric tensor, let's write it as G inverse of x. Remember, the tensor itself doesn't carry indices. It's coordinate functions that carry indices, which is, by the way, exactly like in quantum mechanics. See, for example, an operator Q doesn't carry any indices in quantum mechanics. But now, write down the matrix elements for a basis, right, where these are basis vectors. Then you get here q hat n m. And you can write that q hat is equal to sum over n and m, coefficients q hat n m. And then you have n m, right? So the operator itself doesn't have indices. It's only in a basis that it acquires indices. And the same happens here. Doesn't have indices. Here's the basis. And here are the coordinate functions. Now, the inverse of the metric is a contravariant two tensor, twofold contravariant tensor. Let's say that the E nu are the dual bases to the theta mu, which means that once we've chosen the theta mu, so a basis of the cotangent space, then the dual basis is that basis of vectors e mu, which have the property that e mu evaluated on theta nu is the Kronecker delta. We had this before in one of the earlier lectures. So the e mu are a basis of the tangent space, just like the theta mu are a basis of the cotangent space. Now, the g inverse is a vector that's twofold contravariant. So therefore, it is a linear combination of these basis vectors in the space of twofold contravariant tensors. And here are the coefficient functions. And traditionally, we write those with upper indices. Keep in mind, again, these are functions, therefore zero forms. And that's not a form at all, not a form at all. It's just a basis vector in the tangent space, basis vector in the tangent space. And here we are starting a theme that will become more and more important during the course. We choose here basis vectors of the cotangent space. And I said that these basis vectors, for convenience, could be chosen to be simply the dx mu. But remember that the cotangent space is an n-dimensional vector space, and it has any number of bases, right? You can choose whatever basis you want, and the dx mu are just a convenient basis. It's convenient because we work with a coordinate system usually anyway. And so why not use the basis in the cotangent space that comes with that coordinate system? Well, there are good reasons why we may not. You see, in elementary courses of general relativity, this is the canonical choice. People choose the coordinate system, and then they choose the dx mu automatically as the basis for the contention vector spaces. But we don't have to choose that. We can choose the basis vectors whichever way we want. So this is a very important statement that I'm going to make now. We can choose the coordinate system freely for our manifold. And once we've made that choice, we are still free to choose what basis we use for the cotension spaces, what basis we choose for the tension spaces. Those choices have nothing to do with each other a priori. It's just that for convenience, once we choose a coordinate system, we may as well go with these basis vectors. But there are better choices.
Once you fix a basis for the tangent space, don't you fix a basis for the contingent one?
You don't have to, but it's super convenient to choose the dual basis such that, you know, if you choose the basis in the cotangent space, choose the basis for the tangent space to be the dual basis consisting of E's such that if you evaluate them onto each other, you get a Kronecker delta of mu nu.
Is there an instance where it could be...
Where we don't do that?
Where you would like to do that, like choose different bases? Like.
I don't know of one. You might want to do it, but it is really very convenient. But what is super important is not to stick to this.
Right?
And we will soon see why that is. Okay, so now here, a modern view, modern mathematical view of the Einstein equivalence principle. So here's the old view. We asked that for every point in the manifold, for every event in the manifold, there is a coordinate system such that when choosing these canonical bases that come with the coordinate system, then the metric can be written in this way, where the coefficient functions are given by evaluating the metric on these basis vectors, where this obeys that at the point in question, the metric tensor reduces to just being eta mu nu. Right? So remember, what that means is the Einstein equivalence principle holds if you can choose an arbitrary point of the manifold and you will find a coordinate system such that in that coordinate system, the metric takes this form if you choose these bases for the tangent and cotangent space. Right? Now, the modern formulation of the Einstein equivalence principle is this. Your metric tensor obeys the Einstein equivalence principle if, independently of any choice of coordinate system, there exist choices of dual bases, theta mu of x and e nu of x, of the tangent and cotangent space, such that the metric tensor's coefficient functions in that basis, right? Remember that G is twofold covariant, therefore it eats up two tangent vectors. So if we feed it two tangent vectors of the basis that we choose here, then this coefficient function is eta mu nu everywhere all at once. You see what happened here? If we insist that with the choice of coordinate system, that's the old thing, if we insist with the choice of coordinate system that we automatically choose these bases, then the best we can achieve is that G mu nu is eta mu nu at one point. We can achieve it for every point, but for every point we need to choose a different coordinate system to achieve this, right? If I choose this point, I need a particular coordinate system such that G mu nu is eta mu nu there. If I choose that point, I need a different coordinate system such that G mu nu is eta mu nu there. And the coordinate system here that does the job here of making G mu nu equal eta mu nu here is not the same coordinate system in general that will make at this point G mu nu equal to eta mu nu, right? However, why is that? It's because at this point, one choice of coordinate system comes with the basis of dx mu. And at that point, another coordinate system comes up with a basis of dx tilde mu and so on. And these bases are such that here the g mu nu is eta mu nu, and there the g mu nu is eta mu nu. But it's not the same coordinate system. But as we just discussed, The choice of coordinate system is independent in principle from the choice of what basis we choose in the tangent and cotangent spaces. So if we allow ourselves the freedom to choose the basis vectors in the tangent and cotangent spaces freely, then we can actually arrange the metric tensor's coefficient function to be always this, everywhere, all at once. And this is very useful. For example, we can write down a, we can describe a curved space-time. It may have black holes, it may be expanding and all of that. And we want to write down the Dirac equation, for example. Now, for the Dirac equation, remember, we need to introduce gamma matrices. And these gamma matrices have a particular anti-commutator relation that involves the eta mu nu. Imagine if it wasn't eta mu nu, if it was g mu nu of x, which changes from position to position. Then you would have gamma matrices that depend on space and time. That would be super tedious to work with. But what we see here is that if we allow ourselves to choose bases suitably, not tied to coordinate systems, but just independently, then we can choose at every point in space-time. We can choose a basis of the tangent and cotangent vector spaces such that g mu nu is eta mu nu there. Now, all the non-triviality is no longer in these coefficient functions because they're always just eta mu nu. No, now all the non-triviality, all the information about the curvature is no longer encoded in the behavior of the g mu nu x of x functions. Now all the non-triviality is in describing which basis they are, right? So you need to choose this basis here, that basis over there, this basis over here, that basis over there, such that the metric tensor takes this form. So we describe curvature then no longer through non-triviality of coordinate of metric functions g mu nu of x. No, in that case we describe it through the specification of which bases are diagonalizing the metric. We will get all of this in much more detail. I'm just anticipating. The only thing you really need to take away at this point is what I actually wrote down. OK, so now we can describe infinitesimal distances through g mu nu of x. Once we have the metric, as we do here, what else follows? What can we do now that we have the metric, now that we know how to describe the distance between two events as long as they are very close together? Well, the metric and its inverse give us a duality between covariant and contravariant vectors and tensors, as we will see. Technically, you probably saw this before, we can use them to raise and lower indices. So the metric provides an isomorphism between the tangent and the cotangent space, an explicit isomorphism. The metric also induces a map that shows that the space of p forms is isomorphic to the space of n minus p forms. We can map every p form uniquely, canonically, into an n minus p form and vice versa. And with this map, we can turn the Grassmann algebra of differential forms into a Hilbert space for Riemannian manifolds. For Lorentzian manifolds, where the metric is not positive definite and then includes space-time, it's not actually Hilbert space because the inner product is not going to be positive definite. But it's important to see how that comes up because nature is trying to tell us something there. Nobody has quite figured out what it is telling us there, but that's how it is. And the metric gives us what is called the co-derivative, which is yet another derivative. And it has the property that, unlike the exterior derivative, which increases the degree of the differential form by 1, the co-derivative is decreasing the degree of a differential form by 1. So it maps two forms into one forms, etc. Actually, the co-derivative, just to already anticipate it, is simply the adjoint of the exterior derivative, the adjoint with respect to some inner product. So it's basically the Hermitian conjugate of it, if you like to think of it this way. So the exterior derivative and the co-derivative delta behave like a dagger. You know, one is the adjoint of the other. It's the Hermitian conjugate of the other. And once we have both of them, the exterior derivative, well, we have that already. Once we have also the co-derivative, then we can obtain from that the Laplacian and D'Alembertian operators, which are second derivatives, which map p-forms into p-forms. And once we have the Laplacian and D'Alembertian, we can, of course, write down equations of motion on the space-time, such as the Klein-Gordon equation. But let us start with cleaning up something that I anticipated before. Remember when we introduced the volume form? We had to introduce the volume form in order to be able to write down the divergence of vector fields, which in turn we needed to show that the Stokes theorem includes as a special case the Gauss theorem. At that point, all we needed was the volume form. We did not need a metric for this. And remember why that was. The divergence of a vector field describes how much of this divergence of vectors is actually happening, right? So a curl of a vector field is when, you know, the vector field goes around in circles, something like this. But the divergence is something like that. And how much of this is going on in a vector field requires some notion of volume. I mean, for example, it could be water being pumped by a tube into an aquarium, and then, you know, the flow, the vector field can tell you how much water per second is being pumped into that aquarium. Clearly, the notion of volume is important. That's why we needed the volume form. But then we already discussed that once we go deeper into the mathematics and describe a metric and describe distances, we should be able to infer from the notion of distances what the volume is. So the volume form should be derivable from the metric. And that's what we will do now. So let's say we are given a notion of distance, that is to say a metric tensor G. Then this actually also induces a volume form omega. Remember what a volume form is? A volume form is a top form. So if the spacetime is n-dimensional, the volume form is an n form, the highest degree that a differential form can have. And it has to be positive everywhere. That's a volume form. So let's assume that our manifold is oriented. And let's assume that we are considering a positive chart. Remember that for an oriented manifold, we have a bunch of charts that cover the entire manifold, and all the Jacobian determinants are positive. And now let's say we have a chart which, if we go into that chart, the Jacobian is also positive. This is all just making a difference of a minus sign at most. Okay, then the induced volume form, induced by the existence of the metric, the induced volume form takes this form. It is an n form, and the basis of the space of n forms is one-dimensional, right? There's only one dimension in the space of n-forms because there's only one basis vector we can write down, and that's all of the dxi lined up in a wedge product, totally anti-symmetric. So the n-form, the volume form, of course, takes the form of some function times this basis vector, and that function is the square root of the absolute value of the determinant of the matrix function here. And the claim is that this is a well-defined volume form. Now, that's non-trivial because we could, for example, instead say, well, all right, this involves the metric, all right, but what if instead of taking the square root, we took the seventh power of it? Is that not also a volume form? You see, what we have to check here is the following. This is a definition in a coordinate system, right? So we chose some coordinates, x mu, and then we say, in this coordinate system, this is our volume form. But now imagine I had chosen to work with a different coordinate system of the x tildes. And then I write down that formula and say, oh, that's my volume form. How do I know it's the same form? Right? It would be foolish to define a volume form with explicit reference to a particular coordinate system. And if we defined the same formula in a different coordinate system, we would get a different form. That would not be good. Our definition needs to be independent of the human choice of which coordinate system we choose. So let's verify that this is obeying the axioms, the definitions for a volume form, and in particular, it's well defined. So no matter what coordinate system we write it down in, it gives us the same omega. So that would make it a canonical volume form derived from the metric. So first, we need to check, is it non-zero for all p? And positive, and it is, because g, the metric, is assumed non-degenerate. So the determinant is never zero. It's invertible everywhere. Determinant is never zero. And we take the absolute value of that. That makes it positive. Taking the square root of that still leaves it positive. So that's OK. But now we have to check, is it well defined? That is to say, is the definition chart independent? Now, to see this, let's say we calculate the same thing in a different chart. So we go from coordinates x to coordinates x tilde. Now, we have the metric tensor is a twice covariant tensor. And therefore, its coordinate functions, and we are using now, still following the usual tradition, we are implicitly using the basis of the cotangent and tangent space that's induced by the coordinate system. We have that the coefficient function in the tilted coordinate system is given by the coefficient function in the untilted coordinate system multiplied with these Jacobians here. Because it's a covariant tensor, we have dx by dx tildes. If it was a contravariant tensor, for example, its inverse, then we would have dx tildes by dx's here. Now, we can view this as the multiplication of three matrices. Here's a matrix, there's a matrix, there's a matrix. But this matrix actually is contracting the R index with the first here and this matrix with the second one there. So in terms of matrices, the G tilde matrix is this matrix times that matrix times this matrix. So we write it in this way. So it's this matrix transpose, then G, then that matrix. We need the determinant of this. So we take the determinant of this, of G tilde, which is the determinant of this product of three matrices. And the determinant stays the same under transposition. So therefore, the determinant of G tilde is the determinant of the Jacobian matrix squared times the determinant of G. And therefore, also we have the square root. So the square root of the determinant of G tilde, of the absolute value of the determinant of G tilde, is equal to the determinant here times the square root of the determinant of G. Now, let's look at how this basis vector is transforming under change of coordinates. Well, this basis vector is transforming from the x coordinates to the x tilde coordinate system with this determinant of the Jacobian matrix. It's the determinant because these guys are all totally antisymmetric. In principle, we have here for every one of these basis vectors a Jacobian matrix. But because the whole thing is totally anti-symmetrized, and we had that in a previous lecture at some point, what we end up with here is just the determinant of the Jacobian matrix. And this means that when we write down that formula here in one coordinate system or in the other coordinate system, then their relationship is this. The g tilde, square root of g tilde times the dx tilde formula. So if we use that formula in the tilted coordinate system, we get this quantity, which is, as we just calculated, having one determinant of the dx tilde by dx and coming from the change of coordinates affecting the covariant indices, and another determinant of the Jacobian matrix, but this time the other way around, coming from the change of coordinates impact on this basis vector here. And those two things just cancel each other out. which means that we obtain square root of g and that which is the same formula. So what we see is that we obtain the exact same volume form if we define it like this in one coordinate system or with the exact same formula in the other coordinate system. The reason is that this transforms with the inverse factor than that. That's why we have here two Jacobian factors that cancel each other out exactly. That's why the volume form has the square root in there. If we had chosen any other power, it wouldn't have worked out because then this determinant would have another power. You see, this determinant is super important here. Right? We have square root of determinant of g tilde is equal to Jacobian times square root of g, and that only works for the square root. You probably remember the Levi-Civita tensor, which has a very long, nice-sounding name, and is still so simple, right? It's just a totally anti-symmetric tensor, epsilon, normally written with three indices, but it generalizes to any number of indices just by total anti-symmetry. If any two indices are the same, the entry of the Levi-Civita tensor is zero. If none of the indices are the same, then you get a plus one if you get from that distribution of indices to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, to n with an even number of permutations. And if you need an odd number of permutations to sort them out, then you get a minus one here.
Professor, is it really a tensor or just always confused, or just a collection of symbols? I mean,
well, that's a very good question. That's exactly the point.
Or is it a pseudo tensor?
Sorry, what?
Or the epsilon symbol is a pseudo tensor, right?
This symbol here in special relativity is a tensor. In general relativity, it's not. But in general relativity, we can make it one, right? Because that's what the volume form really is about. And the difference between the Levi-Civita symbol and the omega is the square root of g. That's what we are missing. You see, in Minkowski space, that's just one. And therefore, in Minkowski space, this is an n form. But in general curved space times, it's not. There we have to have the square root of g in there. You see, the omega here, this thing here, can be written as we did. We define it as square root of absolute value of the determinant of g. Absolute value, because for Minkowski space and for Lorentzian manifolds in general, this determinant would be negative, and so we'd have to take the absolute value of it. So this is the definition of it, but we can spell out what this thing is. It's the total anti-symmetric, anti-symmetrized tensor product of all of those, which is to say we sum over, and then we have the Levi-Civita, totally anti-symmetric tensor, and here we have the basis vectors in the tension space, basically in the tension space, right? And so if you sum all of that up, you obtain exactly this. So what we see here is that the volume form in this basis in the coordinate system is given by the omega I to omega n times these basis vectors. And what this actually is simply square root of g times this totally anti-symmetric tensor there. So omega, this volume form, is called the canonical volume form for a metric manifold. But in principle, say, I think I mentioned it before, in principle, you could consider the possibility that nature has a different volume form that's not induced from the metric. But it would be weird. It's been tried, though.
But if you try to construct a form, the metric that has this property, when you change the coordinates, you have the same expression. This is the only expression, right?
From the metric, you get this, yes.
The only one. But this
the only one, yes. Yes. You see, you have to consider what scalar do I get from the metric, and it's going to be the determinant. And then you, the only question is what power, and we derive that it has to be the square root.
Oh, yes, yes.
Okay, so what else can we do now that we gave the space-time a metric? Well, we want to describe now, for example, wave equations such as the Maxwell equations and such as the Van-Gordon equation. So that we will follow the following strategy here. In order to get these second derivatives, right, Laplacian, D'Alembertian, they're second derivative operators, we need to essentially apply a derivative twice. But what can we do here? You see, it's not a directional derivative, so you shouldn't use a Lie derivative, for example. Of course, we could do second Lie derivatives, but that requires a direction. But we do have the exterior derivative. But we can't take the square of it. I mean, we can, but the square of the exterior derivative is zero. So all our wave equations would be zero equals zero. That's no good. So what we can do is we will derive another derivative from the D such that we can build a second derivative out of it. And for that, we follow the following strategy. First, we use the metric to raise and lower indices. That is to say, to map contravariant and covariant components into each other. From there, we can define the so-called Hodge-Star map, which shows an equivalence between R forms and N minus R forms. We already know that the dimension of the space of R forms is the same as the dimension of the space of N minus R forms. And then, once we have these tools, we can define the so-called coderivative. And with the coderivative, we can then write down the Laplacian and D'Alembertian. And to give it away already, we get a beautiful formula. The D'Alembertian, or also the Laplacian, is given by the anti-commutator of the exterior derivative and the coderivative. So it's d del plus del d. So for example, the Klein-Gordon equation can then be written down, where this D'Alembertian is d del plus del d. And it's a Klein-Gordon equation not only for functions, the phi may be a function, but we can also, in principle, write it down for one forms, two forms, three forms, etc. OK, so we follow that strategy. And the first point is raising, lowering indices with G. What is it really? It's isomorphism between a canonical isomorphism induced by G between the tangent and the cotangent space. So G, the metric, can be used as a map. Namely, G can map, remember, it's a twofold covariant tensor. So it takes two tangent vectors as input and outputs a number. But if you input one tangent vector, then you're still left with a cotangent vector. Right? So if we take the metric tensor, and then we can view it as mapping a tangent vector into what you get when you apply that. If you stick that tangent vector into the metric. So we take the metric tensor, which is written as coordinate functions times basis vector, tensor basis vector. And then we apply that. We apply one factor of it. It's symmetric in the two, so it doesn't matter which one. We apply one covariant factor of it onto the tangent vector as input. And then what do we obtain? Well, we have that this theta nu is acting on these ei. Thetas are basis vectors of the cotangent space. The ei are basis vectors of the tangent space. Remember that cotangent vectors map tangent vectors into numbers. And in particular, because they are chosen to be dual bases, we here get a Kronecker delta between nu and I. And so overall, what we obtain is that the G mu nu of X matrix gets contracted with the Xi nu column vector to give us a new coefficients functions for this cotangent vector. So we take a covariant 2 tensor and stick in a tangent vector, and we get out a covariant 1 tensor, which is a cotangent vector. This is all just a clean, abstract way of what we mean by, lowering indices. Because we take this tangent vector and we effectively lower its index here, right? Because we just take xi nu and then the g mu nu contracts with it to give us a new tangent vector. So for the coefficient functions, we have that the xi mu go into g mu nu xi, g mu, g nu rho, xi rho. Those two are getting contracted here. And so this tangent vector coefficient column vector goes into this cotangent vector's coefficients. And conversely, we can take the inverse of the metric, which is a twofold contravariant tensor, feed it a tangent vector and get out a cotangent vector and get out a tangent vector. And that is the same as what you know as raising indices. So in this way, the metric and its inverse can lower or raise any tensor index. It can map covariant parts of tensors into contravariant parts of tensors and vice versa. It's an isomorphism because it's linear and invertible. And this we now use to define the Hodge-Star map. The purpose of the Hodge-Star map is that it shows an equivalence of p forms to n minus p forms. So we can map every p form into an n minus p form and vice versa. It's an invertible map. And how does that work? It's actually going to be super important. It's a bit of a difficult thing here. It's just, it looks perhaps a bit dry, but let me motivate it by saying that super important because we need that to define the Hilbert space of differential forms. And we also needed to define the Dannenbergschen. We needed to define the Maxwell equations. So the Hodge-Star is an isomorphism. It's a map from p forms into n minus p forms. And it works in the following way. We use this trick with the raising and lowering of indices. So what we do is this. We take a p form, nu, and remember that the p form is just a covariant tensor. Right? A p form is a covariant p tensor, so it has p covariant indices, and because it's a form, it's totally antisymmetric. Right? Every differential form is a covariant, totally antisymmetric tensor, but not every tensor is covariant and totally antisymmetric. So not every tensor is a differential form, but every differential form is a tensor. So we interpret the p form as a tensor, as the covariant tensor. And then we notice, oh, all its indices are lower indices because it's covariant. And then we use the metric as many times as is needed to lift all of its indices. So now what used to be a p form is now mapped into a p-fold contravariant tensor. And having a p-fold contravariant tensor, we can feed it into the volume form. Why? Because the volume form is a covariant tensor. It's a covariant n tensor. A covariant n tensor is ready to accept up to n tangent vectors, feeds on them, and outputs a number, right? But we're only going to give it a p tensor, a contravariant p tensor. So if we feed a contravariant p tensor into an n form, such as the volume form, what's left over is an n minus p form. That's the form that we wanted to map into. So concretely, we take a differential form, nu, which is a p form. So it's a linear combination of these basis vectors of p anti-symmetrized dxi's. And we can write that in terms of a tensor. We just remember that, yeah, it's a form, but that just means it's anti-symmetrized tensors. It's a totally anti-symmetrized tensor. So and the only difference between these coefficient functions or that coefficient functions is a factor of 1 over p factorial that is there in the definition of the wedge product to compensate for the anti-symmetrization. So now we take these coefficient functions and use the metric to canonically lift its indices. So we obtain a new tilde tensor, which is a contravariant tensor. So it's a linear combination of these basis vectors. See, these are the basis vectors of the contravariant, of the p-fold contravariant tensors. And we have these coefficient functions with upper indices, and those are obtained from the ones with lower indices by lifting with the metric. So we take the indices of the form and lift all of them, and then we get this contravariant tensor. And then we feed that contravariant tensor nu tilde, which is a p tensor, into the volume form, which is an n form. So here is the volume form, and it feeds on this, it's an n form, and it feeds on this p form. And that leaves us with an n minus p form, which has these coefficient functions, where we have contracted the n indices, they're totally endosymmetric of omega, with the p indices of the nu tilde. And this is only possible because this guy has upper indices, and that has upper indices because we lifted them with the metric here. This whole procedure here of taking a p tensor, viewing it as a p form, viewing it as a tensor, and then lifting all its indices to make it a contravariant tensor, and then feeding it into the volume form, all of that is summarized in this definition. We say star of a new form, Hodge star of a new form, is exactly what we obtained by this procedure. It's what you get when you take the volume form and plug into it the nu tilde contravariant p tensor. P tensor. P fold contravariant tensor. So this thing is a differential form. It has coefficient functions with respect to the tensored basis, but we can also write it in terms of a form. It has these coefficient functions. The 1 over n minus p factorial just arises from the definition of the wedge product. It anti-symmetrizes and divides by that factorial term. Now, what happens if we do this twice, if we do the Hodge star operation twice? Well, then, applying it once maps a p form into an n minus p form. If we apply that again, then it maps the n minus p form back into a p form. But not exactly the same. It's the same up to a minus sign. And that has to do with the anti-symmetrization and whether or not n and p are even or odd. So overall, the formula is that if you apply twice the Hodge star, then you can work out with quite a bit of effort that this gives you the original p form back up to a possibly a minus sign that depends on p, on n, and also on the so-called signature of the space-time metric, where the signature is the sum of the ones and the minus ones in the metric when you put it in the form of eta. So for space-time, that would be 2. Now, why did we define this Hodge star? Well, we define Hodge star because we can use it to turn the space of differential forms into an inner product space, so almost a Hilbert space. The Hodge star provides us with a scalar product where we can take two differential forms and then calculate a number out of them. And the way we can do that is this. Remember, when we have a p form, we can integrate it over a p-dimensional manifold. An n form, we can integrate over an n-dimensional manifold. The inner product for function spaces are typically obtained by integrating, right? You take one function, another function, and integrate over the entire manifold. That's what we want to do here. And let's say we have two p forms. How could we calculate their inner product? Now, the idea is that if you have that alpha and beta are p forms, then we define their inner product to be the integral over the manifold, so an n-dimensional integral, of alpha veg star beta. And this works out because star beta is an n minus p form. Alpha is a p form. So therefore, the wedge product of the two of them is an n form, which we can integrate over the manifold. So again, alpha is a p form, beta is a p form. If they have different degrees, if this was a p form, that was a q form, and n is not equal p, then the inner product is defined to be 0. But if both of them are p forms, then alpha veg star beta is an n form, right? Because that's still a p form, and star beta is an n minus p form. So the veg product of them is an n minus p plus, plus p form, so it's an n form. Therefore, can be integrated over. Yeah? Yeah, and by linear combination, this is extended to all differential forms. So a general element of the Grassmann algebra of differential forms is a sum of various p forms of, you know, one forms, two forms, three forms, etc. And using this formula, you can calculate the inner product between any linear combinations of forms. Now, the thing is that if the metric that we work with is positive definite, as it is for a space, for a Riemannian manifold, not space-time, but as it is for just space alone, then it turns out that this inner product is also positive definite. And that means that by completion, this inner product space of the differential forms becomes a Hilbert space. But it turns out that if G, the metric, is indefinite, so that lengths, so that distances can be both positive and negative, as is the case in space-time, where we have space-like and time-like distances, in that case, that inner product is not actually strictly positive. It can also go negative, and that means that we cannot make this inner product space into a Hilbert space. As I mentioned before, nature is trying to tell us something here. It's not clear, though, what. At the very least, it tells us, work harder. Figure out what to do with this.
Nature is trying to tell us what?
Well, you see, it would be a Hilbert space if there was no time. If there was just space coordinates, just spatial directions, then we would have a Hilbert space of fields, and that's nice, just like in quantum mechanics. But it's not, right? Because we have space-time, the metric is indefinite, and that means that this inner product is not strictly positive, meaning that alpha comma alpha is not necessarily larger equal 0. And therefore, we cannot turn this into a Hilbert space.
But
there's a complication.
Suppose that the metric was definite and you could have a Hilbert space.
Yeah.
Would this help somehow to merge this into the framework of quantum mechanics, like smoothly?
Probably. But it's not the case. So yeah. OK, so now, however, we have an inner product space here. And we can define an adjoint for the exterior derivative now, which is like the Hermitian conjugate. And that will be called the co-derivative. And it works the way that we always define adjoints. Never mind this business, I'll tell you in a sec. So this is an inner product here, and we may write it, I wrote here the same notation as we would in quantum mechanics with the Brandeis-Ketz and these angled brackets here, right? But if you remember from quantum mechanics, what would be the adjoint operator? If you have an in quantum mechanics, if you have an operator A acting on a vector Z, and then you take the inner product with the vector V, so this is a Brad, this is a Ket vector, right? Then the adjoint operator, A dagger, which in a basis would be the Hermitian conjugate, acts in the following way. A dagger acting on V, and then inner producted with Z gives you the same value, right? So the definition of the adjoint or Hermitian conjugate of an operator is this, that if the original operator acts on Z, and then you have the inner product with V, that gives you a number, and by definition, the A dagger acts on V such that its inner product with Z gives you the same number for all Z and for all V. That's the abstract definition without specifying the basis in which you work. This definition is non-trivial, though, in general for infinite dimensional vector spaces, because the Zs are from some domain, and the V might be from a different domain. So the domain of the operator A, that is to say, the set of vectors Z on which A is allowed to act, can be a different set from the set of vectors on which a dagger is allowed to act. And the exact definition of the domain of a dagger is here. We could go into this for hours now. It's actually quite important, but it gets us away from differential geometry into functional analysis.
Our space, vector space, is finite dimensional.
No, these differential forms are from infinite dimensional vector spaces. At every point, the vector space of P forms is finite dimensional, but on the manifold, the vector space of differential P forms is a function space and therefore infinite dimensional. And therefore, there are non-trivial issues arising, especially if the manifold has boundaries. You see, an operator is self-adjoint if its domain, if it acts the same way, and if its domain is the same, in the domain of the adjoint is the same as the domain of the original operator, and that is generally non-trivial. Choices to be made if you have boundaries, and then you have to make choose boundary conditions, and your choice of boundary conditions changes, for example, the spectrum of an operator. So you get different operators there. Okay, but all I wanted to say here, the key message to take away is this, that we define the co-derivative as the adjoint under this inner product of the exterior derivative. Meaning, concretely, that what we have defined here allows us to write down in particular this. We can have a differential form alpha here and the exterior derivative of a differential form beta there. For example, this might be a 3 form and beta might be a 2 form. Then d beta is a 3 form. So we have the inner product of two 3 forms. And we can work it out using the hot star and the way we integrate and all of that. And now what we define here is that the co-derivative acts on alpha in such a way, by definition, that its inner product with beta gives us the same value up to minus sign. So it's what is called an anti-adjoint. So it gives us the same number for all alphas and betas, right? So for all alphas and betas, so the D, instead of acting to the right, we acted to the left. You know that from quantum mechanics, if you have, let's say, unitary time evolution operator acting on the right on a vector in a product, you might as well throw it on the left vector, but then you have to take the Hermitian conjugate of it, right?
And here from the beginning, alpha and beta are still, they are still formed with the same degree like before.
Well, beta has to have 1 degree less if it's to be non-zero, right? Because... Right? Because the But remember that this extends to whatever degree. It's just that if they are of unequal degree, then the inner product is zero.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so the delta is the anti-adjoint of the D. See, historically, this stuff was, of course, not arrived at in this way. But instead, people tried out a gazillion things and stuck with what worked. And how do you know it works? It works because you find out, oh, it actually doesn't depend on the choice of coordinates that I made, right? But in hindsight, then differential geometers went into it and said, what did we actually do here? And then you find out that that's just what you did. So Einstein certainly didn't do any of this. Okay, so the co-differential delta is then explicitly what? Well, it maps P forms into P minus 1 forms. And the claim is that it maps a P form nu into up to a possible minus sign that depends on N, P, and S, S being the signature of the manifold. It's just hot star D hot star. Right? Remember, the exterior derivative acts on nu simply by applying d on nu. But The quaderivative is the adjoint of that. So it's actually doing hot star, and then the exterior derivative, and then hot star. So you take your p form, turn it into an n minus p form, apply the exterior derivative, get an n minus p plus 1 form, apply the hot star to that, and obtain a p minus 1 form in the process. It turns out that if you do it twice, you get 0, just like the d squared is 0. And that's why it is 0, of course, right? Because it's just the adjoint of something that, when squared, is 0.
Sorry, Professor, what's the S, I think?
Oh, S is the signature of the space-time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's just an integer. And in coordinates, the co-derivative of a differential p-form has these coefficients. Now, remember that if the manifold is contractible, then every closed differential form is also exact. So if the differential form has the property that the d of it is 0, then the differential form can be written as the d of another differential form. And the same is true for the coderivative. It inherits this general property, namely that if the manifold is contractible, so it has no holes or handles, then if the differential form is what is called not closed, but co-closed, because it's with respect to the coderivative, then it is itself the coderivative of another differential form. Remember, that's needed if you want to write if you want to see how complex integration with the residue theorem arises as a special case of Stokes' theorem, then the Cauchy-Riemann equations are this one, and d of nu is equal to 0. Okay, it's a little exercise for you if you want to check these statements. And also, you may wonder, is this also a derivation? Does it obey the Leibniz rule? And the answer is no, it doesn't. Right? It's not a derivation. Well, and the reason is that the metric is messing it up.
Well, we call it a derivation then.
No, we don't. It's a derivative. Oh. A derivation is actually obeying the Leibniz rule.
Oh.
Okay, so now that we have the d and the delta, we can do fancy stuff. We can, in particular, obtain the Maxwell equations on the manifold. Remember that in electromagnetism, we have electric fields and magnetic fields, and they actually combine in a tensor with these entries here into the so-called field strength tensor, where we have the electric field here on the zero I coordinates, and then in the submatrix, we have the magnetic field. And we see here that the electric field is not a vector-valued field. The magnetic field is not a vector-valued field. Now, together, they're components of a two-form. The field strength tensor is an antisymmetric covariant two tensor. It is the field strength two form. And the current as a four vector, so we're doing the real deal here. This is special relativity and general relativity are fully covariant. So we have that the current field is actually given by a current four vector, which is, you see, we think of the current as being like the charge times the velocity, and the velocity is like a four vector and so on, which is why we usually speak of a current four vector. But technically, we should view the current actually as a three form, obtained by taking the volume form and plugging in this three vector. Now, having the field strength two form and the current three form, the Maxwell equations can be written in this elegant form. The exterior derivative of the field strength tensor is vanishing. Remember the Maxwell equations. There are two kinds. There are the homogeneous Maxwell equations and the inhomogeneous Maxwell equations. The homogeneous Maxwell equations don't have charges and currents in them. These are those. exterior derivative of the field strength two form is vanishing. These equations only involve these guys, not the currents, not the charges. And the inhomogeneous Maxwell equations are that the co-derivative of this field strength two form, which is a three form, is given by it's a one form, and that one form is the Hodge star of the current three form, right? So the current three form plugged into the volume form gives us a current one form, and that's the one form that you obtain by taking the co-derivative of f. Remember that the co-derivative lowers the degree by one.
So professor, I always thought that the grid was like covariant vector.
You can map it into one, because a three form through the Hodge star, you can map into a one form.
Oh.
Right? Yeah. Because the Hodge star is mapping p forms into n minus p forms. Okay. Now, in electromagnetism, the F can be assumed to be an exact two form. Which means that F is the exterior derivative of a one form, A. And that one form is called the four potential. To say that F is an exact two form is the same as to say that the exterior derivative of F is zero. It's the same as saying that we have the homogeneous Maxwell equations, because if F is dA, then the dF is automatically zero, because the d squared is equal to zero. So the moment we say that the field strength tensor is actually derived from an electromagnetic four potential, we are already implying the homogeneous Maxwell equations. And since they do not depend on anything, any further physical input, such as charges and currents, they are also called structure equations, equations that have to hold anyway. And not only electromagnetism, but as we will later see, also gravity has so-called structure equations, equations that hold anyway, where Einstein had no choice, essentially. Now, the gauge principle of electrodynamics is then the observation that if we take any zero form omega and add to the electromagnetic four potential the d of it. Remember, the electromagnetic four potential is a one form, right? So we can describe the electromagnetic field through a one form. The f is simply the exterior derivative of it. If we take this electromagnetic four potential and we add to it the exterior derivative of an arbitrary function, of an arbitrary zero form, then we get another one form that we might call A tilde, and it describes the same physics. How do we know that it describes the same physics? Well, we know because the field strength tensor, the field strength two form, which is dA, has to be the same as dA tilde. And that's because, again, we would have a d squared, right? If the A tilde is the same as the A plus d omega, and the d of that is d squared omega, which drops out. So what that means is that to say that the field strength tensor is the exterior derivative of an electromagnetic four potential implies not only the homogeneous Maxwell equations, it also implies the gauge principle of electrodynamics. So the gauge principle of electrodynamics essentially traces back to d squared equal to zero. to the fact that the coboundary operator squared is zero, which, remember, through Stokes' theorem, means that, you know, boundaries don't have boundaries. So now we can also define, using the co-derivative, the Laplacian and D'Alembert operators, which we need not for the Maxwell equations, but for the Klein-Gordon equation. So how do we define the Laplacian? And the Laplacian is defined to be the antiderivative of the co-derivative and the exterior derivative. It's going to be a second derivative because both of them are differentiating. And the degree is going to be preserved because d is increasing the degree of a differential form by 1, and the co-derivative is decreasing it by 1, so that's fine. Also, the d is the anti-adjoint of the del and vice versa. So that means that if we take the Hermitian conjugate of this, the d becomes the minus del, the del becomes the minus d. D becomes minus del becomes minus d, so the whole thing is Hermitian. And as we said, it's a second derivative that maps p-forms into p-forms because one is raising the degree and one is lowering the degree. In the case of the signature 1 for space-time, the Laplacian is then also called the D'Alembertian. There is a little bit of disagreement in the literature, but I think mathematicians agree that this is always called the Laplacian. And then physicists will sometimes call it the D'Alembertian, namely if it's about space-time. If there's time involved, we will also call it D'Alembertian. So the Laplacian is sort of the more general definition. The D'Alembertian is a special case of a Laplacian when we have space and time. And that Laplacian is then also denoted as d del plus del d. Okay, and then how does it act on a chart? Well, here is the way that when you work it all out, how the D'Alembertian acts in a coordinate system. And I leave it to you as a little exercise to work that one out. What are the properties of the D'Alembertian in the Hilbert space? Well, as we said, it's going to map R-forms into R-forms in this way. And if it's a Hilbert space, then we have that this is positive definite, and we have that this is a self-adjoint operator that depends on the on boundaries, if there are boundaries. And there are properties of the D'Alembertian that are worth mentioning. The D'Alembertian or Laplacian commutes with the hot star operator. It commutes with the exterior derivative, and it commutes with the co-derivative. And those equations will be very important later on when we will study what all of this means for spectral geometry. Spectral geometry is the field that tries to describe the shape of manifolds in terms of the spectrum of the sound that we hear when we make an object with this shape vibrate. And these equations are going to be super important for that purpose, for relating shape to sound. And in case you're wondering, why would we want to do that? Well, the mathematics of shape is differential geometry, is the mathematics of general relativity. The mathematics of spectra is the mathematics of quantum theory, right? So basically, spectral geometry provides a bridge between the mathematics of general relativity and the mathematics of quantum theory. Hence, that's why we will look into this.
Do you have any good review article on that?
Yes. On the homepage of the course, I am referring to an article by Datchev and Hezari that you may want to look up on this topic. Okay, consequences of the self-adjointness of the D'Alembert operators. Well, if they're self-adjoint, they can be diagonalized, they have a real spectrum. For Riemannian manifolds, that spectrum is positive. And then if the Riemannian manifold is compact, if it has a finite volume, then the spectrum is discrete. And that would be the case of objects of finite size with non-trivial shapes. And we can ask, how does the shape relate to the spectrum? So that's spectral geometry. And then here's an application of it. Remember, I showed you how the D'Alembertian acts on functions. on zero forms here, and I asked you to, you know, consider deriving this. Of course, it looks super tedious if you do it with the hot star and so on. But here's another way to do it. Let's write down the Klein-Gordon action. This is how we would write it down in Minkowski space. First derivative of a field, first derivative of a field. We would write down the eta mu nu normally. Now we write down the g mu nu. And then here we need the volume form to integrate over. It's no longer just dxn. No, we also need the square root of g in there for this to be a volume form. And then when we spell all of this out in coordinates, that is to say in a chart, this is how this reads. And remember, this is the Klein-Gordon action, where we have the first derivative of phi, first derivative of phi. But we want to get to the Klein-Gordon operator. And the way we do that, and this is a super important step, please pay close attention. This is the Klein-Gordon action. And now we do an integration by part, such that this derivative here is no longer acting on this phi, but instead it acts on the rest, on everything else, right? That's what an integration by parts does. And the boundary term goes away because we assume the phi to be square integrable. So at the boundary far away, the phi amplitude is going to be negligible. So the boundary terms go away. So when we do the integration by parts, then we have here just a phi, and this derivative will act on this and on that and on that. Right? That's what the derivative does when we do the integration by parts. So we get an over minus sign after the integration by parts. This becomes an undifferentiated phi. And then this d by dx mu here acts on all of that stuff here. Right? It acts on the square root. It acts on the g mu nu of x. And it acts on this derivative. And then I've restored the volume form here by writing a square root of g. So I have to divide by a square root of g. And now we recognize what this is. This is phi, Dannenbergian phi. And all of this is just that. Right? So all of these complications can be very easily seen to arise by just starting with this scalar action, doing integration by parts. It's a shortcut to finding out what the Dannenbergian has to be on a curved space-time. There's no mass term, but you could add one. You just have to be careful not to forget the volume form. Yes. Okay, and then from there, we can get the Euler-Lagrange equation, right? Once we have the action here, we can get the Euler-Lagrange equation. And the Klein-Gordon equation, the master's one, yes, is then Dannenbergian phi is equal to 0. And you can ask, well, which fields are described by the Klein-Gordon equation? And just to give you three examples, meson fields, for example, pions, which are quark-antiquark pairs. These particles are scalar, and they're described by the Klein-Gordon equation. Then there's the Higgs field, the Higgs particle that gives particles their mass. It's described by a Klein-Gordon equation, and with a potential, though. I mean, all of them have potentials. And the so-called inflaton field is also described by the Klein-Gordon equation. And the inflaton field will, of course, concern us a lot later on when we apply GR to cosmology. OK, that's it for today.